the Lose Control Podcast, a paradox to peaceful, positive living that contains raw honesty and uncensored emotions. Matty I here. Thank you for listening to the Lose Control Podcast. We will hear inspiring stories from darkness to redemption that embrace the journey of living life on life's terms, leading to the discovery of your purpose. Welcome back, guys. Episode 6, and I have a really special, unexpected guest and a gift. Hadn't seen this woman in 20 years, probably. And when we ran back into each other, it was the first response was, "You made it like me," because the path that we both were on was just pure destruction. Fortunately, the two of us have found recovery and the beauty that comes with it. But so Nancy,
hi.
Right, how did it come about that we got reconnected? Were you were talking with Paul, or was I?
I was at a meeting with Paul, and Paul starts telling me, he's like, "Hey, you know that Matty from New York?" And I'm like, "I don't know." I was like, "I know a Matty from New York." And he was like, "I think you know him." I was like, "I don't think I know him." Da da da. I looked on Facebook, and I couldn't recognize you. I was like, "I don't know if that's Matty." Yeah, and I was like, "Oh my God, that's Matty!" And I told Paul, "I'm like, man, we ran really hard together."
Yes,
it was a big wow moment because, yeah, it's truly amazing that to find someone in recovery that ran so hard just like me, and we're in recovery running just as hard now for a different life.
Yes, we are, and it's really beautiful. So let's you know, we'll go ahead and let's find out what's been going on the last 19 years or the last 20 years. And we'll just, you know, maybe we'll go back into time a little bit about, you know, growing up and how things kind of created who Nancy was and did the things she did. And so what's been going on the last 20 years?
I'll be 49 in 2 months. And for 30 plus years, I lived in self-pity. I never knew why I kept doing the stuff I was doing. I was constantly, you know, I've been abused. I've been molested. I've had some trauma happen to me, but I let that define me. Like I did, I felt like, okay, because this happened, I had so much hate in my heart. I had so much resentment. I was pissed off. I was always mad at the world, always mad at the people who hurt me. Not a forgiving person. I just lived and wallowed in self-pity, and I found drugs and alcohol.
When did you find drugs?
Well, I first took my drink. I can remember stealing Mad Dog from the grocery store. I was like 16, 17. I got kicked out of high school. Because I was messed up. I came back to school. I was drunk as hell. I threw up in the locker. I was high. I just wanted to run the streets. I wanted that life. I didn't want to miss it. My mom always told me that I had a fear of not missing out. I didn't want to miss out on anything. Smart person, but I let my the lifestyle that I was living, it took me over. So I started, you know, can remember smoking weed and then, you know, experimental, just shrooms, some acid, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. As you know, in my 20s, it was all cocaine and, you know, partying in the Vista. That life was nonstop.
Yes, it was.
It was a blur.
Somewhere about 5 years together, somewhere in the same.
Probably a little more than 5 years.
Yeah, a lot of it's black.
Yeah, a lot I don't remember. A lot, you know, my mom and I will talk and she's like, "You remember when you did?" I'm like, "No, I really, honest to God, I don't remember waking up in places that I shouldn't have been, laying next to people I shouldn't have been laying to, giving myself and my mental, my everything to that lifestyle because I was trying to escape myself. And I didn't know that at the time until I came into recovery. But so the cocaine and the party life, and it was just fast and fun, and I looked good, and I didn't sleep for days. I didn't eat for days. I had a great time is what I thought. And then I was no longer having a great time. Then I got into even harder drugs. I found some crystal meth, and I can remember my first initial thought when I got high. Man, where's this been all my life? I should have done this years ago. What a dumb thing to say. But, you know, so then, of course, that took me down. It took me down really fast. I began my moral, my values were shot. Like the things that I knew better and I knew not to not do, I did. Everything I said I would never do, I did. I crossed everything off. There's two things I haven't done. But I started, you know, of course, lying, stealing, cheating, manipulating. I was not employable. I remember one year I had 12 jobs, 12 W-2s in one year. because I, you know, I'd get a job and it'd be great. I was making money, and 4 or 5 days later, I decided to go on a binge, and then, you know, losing jobs, handcuffed to hospital beds, waking up in a jail. I've overdosed twice in my 20s.
You overdosed twice. What was that?
In my 20s, it was cocaine. Cocaine and the combination of Xanax, right? That had the right combination. And GHB, too.
GHB, that was ugly. That was an ugly combination.
God,
man.
You did a little bit. You were just, you forget, you know, just right. Man. Well, what happened was, you know who this woman was. I know her name is Michelle. How I met her, where I met her, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, she was in my car, her and some guy in the back seat. And I'm driving around. I got a gallon handle of Crown Royal, a bunch of cocaine.
This is your 20s?
It is in my 20s. Yeah, yeah. And then she said to me, I didn't have any more Xanax because I'd break off a little piece of Xanax when I was too jacked up. So I'd break off a little piece of Xanax. I didn't have any more. So this woman who now manipulated me tells me, well, take me by my friend's house. I can get some pills. I'm like, well, are they anything like Xanax? Oh, yeah. They were... oh my God. Methadone. Methadone. Really? I had never heard of methadone.
I only heard of it when you go to clinics.
I had never heard of methadone, right? I was a cokehead. So I take her by there and I thought I took two. Well, they ended up pumping my stomach. I woke up in the hospital. They pumped my stomach. I woke up. My mom and my cousins were all around. I was in a coma for 9 days.
What?
Apparently, there was a lot of that methadone.
What time frame was that?
Sometime in my 20s. I don't know. So like 25, maybe 25-ish.
We know a lot is blacked out, yeah, wow.
25-ish, I want to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I had a lot of methadone and cocaine in my system. Yeah. And so, mind you, like I said, I was in a coma for 9 days. Let's fast forward back to, you know, just 2 years ago. Not even 2 years ago, almost. I was awake for 9 days. And being awake for 9 days, and I'm talking about hallucinations. I was talking to people that weren't even there in my own car. I can remember nights where I drove a Mercedes, right? Only by name. I'd ripped the sunroof out. I ripped the visors out. I ripped the cup holders out just because I was high. And like if something, like I think a drop of water hit my arm and I ripped the cup holder. Yeah, just freaking insane, right? So... up for 9 days, and I remember my last run, I walked into this house. I was with some people. In the backyard, the father was trying to steal my catalytic converter off my car. In one room, when I first walked in, there was a guy with a needle in his neck. The back room, the mother and two daughters were doing some sexual activity for some guys that were watching. There was just like crazy shit. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing here?
It's a trap house.
Yeah, but it was like a beyond trap house, right? So then, and I'm really grateful that I did overdose because I came really close to, I'd never put a needle in my arm. But at that moment, like I kept getting high. I kept using, but nothing was getting me high. I just couldn't get high for 9 days. It's like, I just kept going and going, but I was running on fumes. So I remember going up to the guy who was at the door and I'm like, you know, I've never shot up, but I think I want to try. He goes, you don't want to try this. Once you try this, you will never.
Isn't that amazing that the dude that was banging the vein and he even knew how fucked up it was.
Yeah.
And he told you. Yeah.
He goes, you don't want to try this.
Don't go on this path.
He was like, you will never be the same. I'm like, wow. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I don't like needles. I'm scared of needles. Walked away. But I'm watching him. Then I go back to him. I'm like, no. I think I want to try it. Then like I heard stories like, oh my God, if you hit this in your veins, it's going to get you fucked up. Like, not like I needed to get any higher, but
our crazy minds, we did,
right?
Man.
So I kept going back and forth toying with it, like maybe I will, maybe I won't. My last time, so I said to him, I'm like, all right, no, I really want to try it. He goes, I don't have a clean rig. I'm like, dip it in alcohol, it's fine. Like, what was I thinking? But so anyway, I overdosed when I came to.
So you didn't hit the vein?
No, I didn't. No needles.
How'd you overdose?
I was what I thought was smoking meth and snorting meth. Oh. Well, I mean, who am I getting my meth from? It's not like I got it from a chemist.
Right.
I got it from, you know, I got it from a guy who was doing,
got it from a guy.
He was doing fentanyl. He was smoking crack. He was doing all these other things. He didn't know what the hell was in the bag. He just sold me a bag. And so there was fentanyl in the bag and little remnants of crack. And yeah, so that happened.
So what walked me through the overdose? I mean, like, what happened?
You just, I guess it was fentanyl in it. I don't know.
But you all of a sudden went out. And
I don't. I remember this.
Like flopping like a fish.
Well, I don't know. Here's the great thing, right? So I'm getting high, and my number one thing whenever I got high, and that shit hit me really hard. I got really hot. We were just talking earlier. Mm-hmm. I got really hot, and I always had a change of clothes in the car. So I thought I went to the car to change my clothes. I was found. I don't know what happened. I don't remember anything. When I woke up and I was in the hospital, I had no shoes, no purse, no cell phone, no keys. So apparently, this is after the fact that, you know, I got my mom to take me over to find out where my car is. The police had towed my car. They said, I called the ambulance that came and picked me up, said that they found me in the passenger seat of my car. My car had been ransacked. My purse dumped upside down. They were looking for whatever.
Left you for dead.
The people I was with took me out of the house, put me in the car, left me in the passenger seat. So thank God they called the ambulance. But
at least they did that, though.
Yeah, they hit me.
Well,
with,
that is the saving.
Right, they hit me with Narcan three times to bring me back.
I was gonna ask you, wow.
Yeah, but that didn't wake me up because I just came home. I rested for 4 days.
I was going to ask you before you go. I was going to ask you when you went into coma in the 20s for 9 fucking days. I was going to ask. How did that resonate at all at that time?
The day I came home with an IV in my arm because I had fluids. My cousins and all were at the house. And my cousin says to me, one of them, she goes, you got any of that stuff? And I'm like, I'm sure I got a bag upstairs. I go upstairs, find a bag of cocaine. And while the IV is in my arm, I snort a rail. So no, it didn't. It did nothing. It did nothing.
He's so strong.
Yeah, it did nothing. And even after this last overdose, December 16th, I came home, I rested, I swore I was never going to do it again.
That's December 16th of 2022.
22, yeah.
Right.
I came into recovery January the 5th of 2023. So I'm a little over a year. But I, you know, came home and I was like, I'm never going to do this again. Until I did, which was like 4 days later. And like I said, coming into recovery, I started doing some work to find out why the hell I always do what I did. You know, I kept nonstop that same vicious cycle. And not until I did some work and, you know, got with my sponsor and like dug really deep, did I find out that it's all because of my loneliness, right? So after my overdose, 4 days later, I'm laying in bed, and that was December 16th. So around Christmas time too, I'm laying in bed and I get a phone call from a guy and he's like, hey, it's Christmas, da, da, da. You know, come over, we'll drink some champagne. Okay. So I remember tiptoeing out of my house, holding my shoes. I pushed my car down the hill.
Oh my God, how crazy we are.
Pushed it down the hill because I didn't want anyone to stop me. And I left. It was horrible. But I had promised my nieces that I was going to be there for New Year's Eve. I got home New Year's Eve morning because I didn't want to disappoint anyone.
No.
Right? So, you know, I was still high as a kite.
This is one time.
I'm not going to disappoint you. Mind you, there were so many years where I remember my mom's birthday, and my family means the world to me. I'm Lebanese, and they mean the world to me. We're very close. My mom's birthday, I was coming. I was coming, you know, to get together. We were all going to eat lunch together, dinner together. I never made it. I would always turn my phone on airplane mode because I didn't want their names to come across my phone because that guilt and shame remorse, guilt was going to kill me. I couldn't do it. I couldn't.
That story is so much similar.
I couldn't do it, man. I went on airplane mode because I had to keep my phone on in case I needed to use it, right?
He could have hooked you up to a lie detector tech. I am coming home.
Yeah, I was coming.
There.
I was coming.
I will be there. I will be there. I had a dear friend of mine, and you know him, and that we could count endless holidays. We were together on the back porch, blowing rails, doing whatever, man, and solving the world's problems. Mm-hmm. My favorite Greek friend in the world.
Oh yeah.
And
oh yeah.
And we would Mother's Day, Christmases, mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, all the major fucking holidays.
Right.
And it was a joke up until it's still comedy now, because the comedy is, he says, man, look at us now, you know, it's Mother's Day, and you know, it's right. Mother's Day, you right. know, we're not getting all whacked out right. and not answering phone calls mm-hmm. and not disappointing anyone. Mm-hmm. But it was our running joke for years. Yeah. And it was just, even when we were still getting fucked up, jacked up, we would joke about it.
Yeah.
But inside,
it was killing
we both
us.
Knew.
It was killing me.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I left my house one day. We were going, I have two younger brothers, and my younger brother's birthday, well, we all get together for birthdays. We all go out to dinner. We get together for dinner. And I left my house while I was trying to get ready for my brother's, you know, get dressed to go to my brother's dinner. I left the house because I was going to go buy scotch tape. I got to the Kroger and I got a phone call. This guy, he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm getting ready, good, get ready to my brother's birthday. He was like, and, you know, I felt sorry for myself again because I blew all my money on drugs. So I didn't have money to buy my brother a real gift. I just, you know, bought him a card, some bullshit, blah, blah, blah. And this guy goes, well, you know, I got a lot of stuff in my house. You can come pick out whatever you want. For whatever reason, that sounded like a good idea. I already, you know, I don't know. So I went.
I'll go get him a drill.
So I went. Actually, I got him a, what's her name? Echo, the little Echo, Siri Echo, whatever. So I get there, of course, because, you know, he's a drug addict too. And he, yeah, everybody trades in stuff. Just, hey, I did it too. So I go there. He's like, I got brand new, this Echo Dot or whatever. It's brand new in the box. Here, you want to hit this? All right, just one.
Oh.
That just one. I never made it, man. I never made it. And I felt so, and you know, that guilt and shame kept me out longer than I needed to be out. I wanted to come home. I really wanted to come home. I didn't want to see my family hurt. I didn't want to be such a disappointment to myself and to my family, but I just couldn't. Like, I remember driving home, texting my mom saying, I'm on the way home. Yes, I'm a grown woman and I still live at home. Okay. So I'm on the way home and I text my mom, like, I'm on my home. I fucked up. I did it again. Da, da, da. Same story. She was used to it. She's like, you know, I already know. Nancy, all your texts always begin with, I'm so sorry. All of them for years. So I was on the way home. I drove by my house probably 12 times. I kept passing my house because I'm like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I cannot look her, my mom and dad in the eye. They know what I'm doing. They know the lifestyle that I live, but I couldn't bring myself to look at them. And for them to, my mom would tell me, Nancy, you're fucked up. Just come home. I'd rather you come home and sleep in your room, lay in your bed. Nobody's going to say anything. We'll leave you alone. That's how, I mean, what more do you want? But I was like, no, I could not take that walk up the stairs and look at my family. I couldn't. The hurt and shame that I brought on to myself, no way. It was just horrible. So, you know, I can remember like several times in my early 30s, I think Passages of Malibu, the commercial was on.
Yeah.
I remember going up to my mom one night and I'm like, Mom, I felt like I was going to die. My heart was beating out my chest. I just didn't know what to do. I go into my mom's, you know, wake my mom up. I'm like, Mom, I think I need to go to Passages of Malibu. Like call the number or whatever. It's outrageous. Like I could never afford it. But the next morning, my dad's like, well, if you're serious about this, I'll take out a loan. You know, and I'm like, and I didn't want to do it. I wanted to, but I'm like, no, because I know what's going to happen. I'm going to fuck up again.
We were fucked up and we would think at the later stages uh-huh. of, you know, into my early 40s type of range and came in there, you know, Googling alcoholism, drug, how do you fix it?
Right.
And they started coming out with, that there was surgery they could remove
that part of your brain,
whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, like, I would seriously contemplate doing brain fucking surgery because, you know, I knew because of my earlier time in the meat program mm-hmm. from decades before, and each decade everybody knows the story there, but that I knew what was involved with me to do it organically and freeing myself of these fucking ball and chain and carving into my brain and cutting the piece out just seemed like an easier. That's how warped and fucking it was.
Big time. We're insane thinking we have.
Yes.
But man, I tell you what, my life.
So what was, because we're not there yet. Yeah. What was the point when you knew enough was enough? What was that moment?
So shortly after that.
Take that picture.
That after that last overdose, right? I told you I went back out, came back home. It was New Year's Eve morning. I have two amazingly wonderful nieces. I don't have any children because, hell, I had my life planned out, but it didn't go as I wanted because I wasn't going to find my husband and have kids in a trap house. So it didn't work out that way. but I have two beautiful nieces and a nephew. And I didn't, you know, they know me as Funty. So yes, I was a drug addict when they were little, but like, they don't remember that. You know, my niece just turned 6. So anyway, Funty was supposed to spend New Year's Eve night, you know, poppers and stuff with my nieces. And I did. And New Year's Day, my baby brother came over and he's like, Nance, they were expecting my nephew. No, my nephew was born already, but they were expecting, wanting to have his baptism. So my brother says to me, Nance, you know, I really want you to be the godmother, but I'm just scared you're going to be dead. Like, I don't know when you're going to die. Me and Daniel, both my brothers, they kind of like talk about every night, like, when is she going to die? You know, they never know because like all the nights of my mom, you know, my mom would be at the house. My brother would come over and be like, hey, mom, have you heard from Nancy? That would start chaos. Like my dad would start screaming. My mom would start crying at my, I held everybody hostage, you know, worried about Nancy. How's Nancy? So my baby brother says to me, Nance, you've been a drug addict all my life. My brother's 35 years old. So, you know, he probably didn't remember the first few years of his life, but yeah, for 30 years, I've been a drug addict. So when he said that, I was like, damn, you know, it just took that simple sentence. Nance, you've been a drug addict all my life. And he's my heart and soul. I remember times where me and him, when he was younger, we'd push the couches together and watch cartoons and all that stuff. GHB days, right? Yeah. So I would go to the bathroom, drink a little Kappa G, come back and watch cartoons with my brother and be G'd out, or open the refrigerator and fall into the refrigerator. And he thought I was dead. He would sleep with his finger under my nose and scream, mom, mom, I think she's dead.
Man, that G. We left Manhattan Momentums, mm-hmm. and we headed down to fucking Charleston, me and a couple other buddies, right? And we were going to go paint the town red down there. Got down there at like maybe 11 o'clock, and we all go out. And I remember being in one of the cars that we drove down, and this is like one of the last things I remember. I'm in it, you know, sucking down this G, doing the coke, mm-hmm. you know, drink, you know, the whole deal. Yeah. You know, after hitting a bar, and then I went to the car to hit the G, and then I was in the car, like, doing, I don't even know how, like backspins in the front seat. And they were like, and I remember the one cat looking down at me, you know, buddy. And then the next thing I know, at 4 in the morning in the worst part of Charleston, mm-hmm. I come to with one fucking sneaker on, God. In the middle of railroad tracks, staring at a huddle house. At God. 4 a.m. Yeah, and it's in like crazy. The hood, worst part. Right. And I'm looking down and I got one Adidas on and I'm looking at, and I've never been to Charleston before at this time. I've only, you know, I've only been in Columbia here for whatever, a few years, right. You know? And then I remember they wouldn't let me in the huddle house because I only had one fucking shoe because I was so cold. So I made collect calls and I got called my mom. And then she couldn't make it, so I called my buddy. God rest his soul, George. Yeah, remember George? Yeah, yeah. You know, he died on Jaden's 12th birthday. Fact. But anyway, from the damn, he overdosed. Yeah. But anyway, so I called George and to come get me, and he'll do anything for me. And he came down, and he brought his wife, and came down with wife, and maybe one of the kids that I didn't think both of them were born. But anyway, and he came down, and I told him, bring an 8-ball. Mm. And we met the rest of the guys at another breakfast fucking joint down there, right? But anyway, that's how it went. And that didn't even click to me, man. No. I mean, I woke up like 8 miles from the Market Street in Charleston to the hood next to a huddle house, not knowing what state I'm in, with one fucking shoe, drinking this stuff, put it in my body. It did not matter. Listen, and I wanted more.
Man. It was, you know, when it first hit Columbia, it was sold in these little brown bottles, right?
It was
right?
For weightlifting.
Right. Well, guess what? I went and bought it by the gallon.
That's
right. Yeah, I bought it by the gallon, damn it. I wanted more. This is the date rape drug. I want more, more, more. I woke up one morning, in front of Cracker Jack's on the concrete, in my own piss and vomit and no clothes, like no shirt on. God knows what happened to me, but I was just on the concrete. Like, it's just insanity.
Crazy,
yeah. So my brother, like, you know, drinking GHB and passing out and G'ing out of the refrigerator on the couch, in the bathroom where they had to break down the door. The ambulance came because I'd locked the door while I was snorting cocaine off the bathroom counter and drinking G. So my brother, like, when he said that, it hit me hard. Like, damn, my brother's worried about if I'm going to die. I can't even baptize, be the godmother for my nephew, da da da. That simple thing, right? Something so simple. All forget about all the shit I've done. So we had a friend of ours. He's passed away now, heart attack. But he's a Lebanese guy who I knew nothing about sober houses or nothing about sobriety, period. I just knew, like, go to fancy rehab that I couldn't afford, or that's it. I didn't know anything about AA, anything about NA. So I knew that this guy, my mom would tell me that he runs some kind of, she thought, I thought it was like some kind of rehab that's just low budget, like, you know, not like big time. So I'm like, okay. So I called him. I called him January the 1st. I said, hey, John, this is Nancy. He goes, I said, I need help. He goes, Nancy, I've been waiting for your call for years. So I'm like, okay, well, how do I go about this thing? You know, what do I do? He's like, well, it's 30 days. Just pack a bag for 30 days. And I'm like, all right, where do I go? Gave me this address, but I'm so worried about, because now the shit's real. Now I'm thinking I'm going to some rehab, right? I pack this bag and I know nothing more other than just pack a bag. Well, that was January the 1st. I told my mom, I was like, all right, well, I don't have a certain day I have to check in or anything. So let's just wait. She was like, wait for what? I'm like, I got to wash my clothes. I got to clean up. I got to clean my room. Da, da, da.
Everything you haven't done in 30 fucking years.
Right. So what I did, my brother, who is a pathologist, he went to Duke Med School, very proud sister. Well, I know he keeps his Ritalin in his truck. So he left his keys on the stairs. I go up to unlock the door. I get in his truck. I stole like half the bottle. So it was like, I think 33 pills. I took 33 pills, two little, we're like, what's Ritalin? Come on, I do meth and cocaine.
Right.
So I took two, then took two, like every 30 minutes I took two, because just to, like, I was anxious about going to get recovery. Like, I didn't know what I was getting into. So I'm like, one last hoorah.
They all do that.
Right. You know, I had a little bit of kratom of all things, right? Kratom that I heard when I was, you know, out there. I also got addicted to kratom, and that's something legal.
Except for 14 karat, you can get
You can get it anywhere. You can get it from the gas station, a smoke shop, whatever. But to me, what kratom did, because it's legal, it comes from a plant, da da da. But what it does is it gave me, if I didn't have money, time, or whatever, I couldn't get out of bed. I was drained. And before I get on that run to go find drugs and, you know, that whole cycle, I had to have a little kratom, a shot of kratom. There's capsules, there's powder, but that shit's, that's for wussies. Like, I want the big time, right? Give me that liquid extract. So I would drink that. I'd drink five of them a day,
God,
so what I did is I went to the store. I had like $150. I went and bought $110 worth of kratom. I'm jacked up on Ritalin. And I took the kratom. I was going to take the kratom with me to this place because I don't know what I'm doing, right? I'm like, okay, it's legal. They can't take this from me. And I had like seven Ritalin pills left. I put them in my Tylenol bottle because I'm smart. They're not.
They don't ever know. They don't know about drug addicts.
Yeah, So I go there, right? And my mom just drops me off. And I'm like, oh, shit, it's this house. Come to find out, it's a sober house. I'm a spoiled girl. Like, I've never had, I'm daddy's girl. My daddy takes care of me. I've never had to share anything with anyone unless I wanted to. So I have to share this house with 14 women.
Oh, Lord.
I have a little twin bed. It's like, there's chickens, there's cats, there's dogs, there's shit. I'm like, this is ridiculous. But, you know, they take my kratom, they throw it away, they're going through all my shit. And I'm like, fuck, like this is legal. And they're like, you know, well, this is also something that they give drug addicts to, you know, get off of opioids and da da da. So they threw it away. They take my Ritalin. And so for the first 4 days, I did nothing but sleep. Then they had this bullshit where they had every morning I had to wake up. I didn't know anything about AA, right? They're like, every morning at 7 a.m. we have on awakenings. I'm like, on awakenings? Who the hell wakes up at 7, right?
You go to bed at 7.
Right. I'm just going to bed. So, the first 4 days, I didn't get out of the bed, like, other than get up to this on awakenings, read some shit, go back to bed. I slept all day. People are like, how did you go through detox? And I'm like, my withdrawals, whatever you want to call it, I slept and I ate, the two things that I never did out there. So that's all I did. You know, living in the sober house, first 4 days, I did nothing but sleep. I had my roommate, I had six roommates. So I had my roommate wake me up. because I'm not, you know, I'm just now coming off the streets. I'm not used to going to sleep at a decent time and waking up like normal people. So she'd wake me up at 6:45. She did that for like the first 2 weeks. And then there was a church right across the street. There was a cemetery and a church. So this time I was really done. Like I was really done. I was so over like all the shit that I had done in my past, all the just the bullshit, you know, I was always in a hurry to go nowhere. I was always dressed up to go absolutely nowhere. I'd get dressed up, look so great. My mom would say, "Wow, Nancy, you look so great. Where are you going?" Nowhere. I have nowhere. Like really, it came to a point where the club scene was done. I was dressing up to just drive around to see who was going to call, who I was going to call, what trap house I was going to hang out in. So anyway, I'm now like, I'm sitting outside. I take my morning coffee out. I'd sit outside. I'd look at that cross. And I've always, you know, I always believed in God, but I put God on the back burner because I was living for the world. He wasn't doing things fast enough for me. He wasn't giving me what I wanted when I wanted. Damn it, I want it now.
Damn it, if they got the truth.
I mean, seriously, like, you know, my mom would say, just pray about it. I'm like, man, he can't fix me. You know, there's no way that God can fix me. All the shit that I've been through that he just, and plus, why isn't he fixing me? I mean, you know, if he's such a great God, then fix me. Right. But, you know, not, I'm still doing everything wrong, you know, and then I realized that you can't be living, stealing, lying, cheating, being everything horrible, doing all the bad things and expect God to give you blessings. Doesn't work that way. But, well, not for me, it didn't. So
I'm going to go ahead and say it doesn't work that
no,
way.
No, it just doesn't. It doesn't, man. It doesn't.
We don't have to do that eye thing on that statement. Right, I don't give a shit what the world
thinks. You're right.
It
so, don't like, work that I'm just way. Like, you know, I would pissed off why God is just like everything bad kept happening to me, right? I would be driving one night. One day I'd been up for days and I'm driving and I'm on Lake Murray Boulevard. I'm ready to go home now. All of a sudden, I don't know what happened. I guess because I hadn't been asleep in days. 8 o'clock in the morning traffic. I'm on the curb at CVS Lake Murray Boulevard, pop two tires and my head against the dash. Well, why did that happen? What bad luck I have. Thank God I didn't kill someone. Thank God there wasn't someone walking on that curb and I ran into them and killed them. Like, so I'm like, you know, why won't God do for me? That was God all along, right? Who was protecting me. God didn't say jump in fire. You're not going to get burned, but you know, so all those God moments, right? But I didn't see it then. So I'm sitting down and I'd prayed before, foxhole prayers. Please, God, don't let me get caught. Please, God, don't let me die. Felt my heart beating out of my chest, et cetera, et cetera. So I started, you know, I'm in the sober house. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to try this. Something I've never done. I'm going to really pray to God. And I had a routine and I would pray. And prayer was like, for me, what prayer is talking to God. I talk to him like he's sitting next to me, like he's my friend. I just started pouring out my heart, you know, and just telling him how I was tired of living this way and I wanted change and I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want to hurt myself. You know, he knows all the pain, et cetera, et cetera. And every morning I would wake up and it was like an aha moment. I couldn't wait to go tell this one friend I had in the sober house. I'm like, I couldn't wait to go smoke cigarettes with her every morning to tell her what kind of awakenings are happening in my life, right? I'm like, oh my God, I got to tell you what God's doing. And every day it was something new. So, you know, I had no phone. They took your phone away. You don't have car privilege. You can't go anywhere. You're on blackout. So what I thought was the 30-day program, right? So I was like, okay, I can't do this. I can't live here. This is horrible. This is disgusting. I can't live with these women, people stealing your food, pubic hairs everywhere, shit all the back of the toilet. Like, I couldn't do it. So I couldn't do it. And then I'd have this spiritual awakening. Oh, yes, I can do it. This is for me. So, of course, my behavior, right? I'm still an addict. So I'm supposed to be on a blackout period. I told one of the girls in there, I'm like, can I please use your phone? I just wanted to call my mom and tell her about my spiritual awakenings that God was talking to me for the first time ever. So we were required to go to one meeting a week. And when I caught fire, when that light bulb went off and God came, when I let God in, which God is my higher power, when I let him in, I felt something in my heart. I was like, man, I got this, but I'm going to do this. I was doing something I'd never done before. Sobriety, like I was on fire for it. So, but being that we were only required to go to one meeting a week, so the meetings I went to, you know, I was like, okay, well, you know, I want more. I wanted more because I started, and then I started reading the Bible. And then I started listening to these spiritual, like Joel Osteen and all these other people on YouTube or whatever. And I would listen to them and I heard God talking to me. Like they were telling my story, you know, the brokenness, the part of just being ashamed, the part of just not letting go, all that stuff. I heard God speaking through these people and these different messages I was getting. So I called my mom and I was like, I'm coming home. She goes, no, 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 you're not coming home. You know, you can't come. I found out later on, this wasn't a 30-day program. The program was 9 months to a year. I'll be damned if I'm staying here 9 months to a year in Newberry. I'm that close to home? No way. No way. So it was all, these are the emotions, like, no way. I'm right down the road from my house. I can't go there. You know, we'd go to this one meeting and I'd have to pass my brother's house, but I can't stop and see my brother. I can't talk to my brother. I can't call my mom. So the battle wasn't like I wanted to go out and do things. It was just I wanted to be with my family. You know, some of these women didn't have homes. Some of them were living in their car. Some of them were living on the street. I have a family. I have a home. You know, let me go home and work on my recovery. So
they had to structure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was so pissed, man. Don't tell me I can't do this and I got to go to sleep at a certain time. And I don't want to live like a normal human being. You know, like rules are for you guys, not for me. So anyway, so on day 30, because I was like, nope, I'm going to make it 30 days. That's, you know, I'm going to make it. And I did. On day 34, I left. Packed up my stuff. My mom came to get me. I went to my very first counseling session. I've never had a therapist, counselor, or whatever. Well, in this sober house, they took you and, you know, got this counseling appointment. So I spoke to someone. I got all the trauma and all the shit that was inside of me that I've been harboring around for so many years. I got it out. And she was pretty much just like, yeah, it's a good thing. But I found that in these rooms. I found that in my network. I've got a network of people now where I can just pour out all my hurt, all my pain, all my everything to. So anyway, so I made and told my counselor, I was like, okay, well, I've got a game plan. I got a calendar, a big calendar. I'm going to write down all the meetings I'm going to go to, write down all my therapy sessions that I'm coming back, driving to Newberry twice a week. I'm going to do all this. So I got home and I told my mom, I was scared shitless because hell, how many times did I say, I'm going to change. Things are different. I'm not going to do it again. You'll see. So I get there and I told my mom then the very next day, I'm like, okay, I'm going to this meeting, you know, Renegade. Like, I'm going there, da-da. She goes, oh, Nancy, I'm worried about you. I'll go with you. And I was pissed. I'm like, you don't need to go with me. I can do this. I'm not going to let you down. My counselor said, listen, if that's what she needs, then let her go with you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I let her go. I went to the meeting with my mommy. and I guess maybe she finally, you know, she saw that there's saw something in me that she's never seen before. So the next day I was like, you want to come with me? She goes, no, Nancy, you got this. You go.
Right on.
Yeah. So it was like slowly but surely little things. Like I went to a meeting. I didn't have a job. So I went to 3 meetings a day and I went to my counseling. And then like my first month in the meetings and I was like, how do I get a sponsor? What do I do? You know, I got turned down by 5 women, but that's fine.
You know, I'm just saying, yeah, the beauty.
Yeah, that didn't stop
me. You get hit by 5, turned down five
women.
And here you are.
Damn right.
You got so much zest. I mean, really.
Damn right. Listen.
I've seen a couple people with, you know, a year, 14 months, you know, early sobriety is under 5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, realistically. So myself is early sobriety, but, you know, being in the program since the 80s,
right.
I've seen a lot of people, but you have, you know, that's one of the reasons I wanted you on the podcast, because you have just a spice and a, as you said, the thrive and the vigor and the desire. And, you know, it's just different than this pink cloud they talk about.
Right.
And even that being said, and enough I'll say it is about the pink cloud is, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Because a pink cloud doesn't have to fucking go away.
It doesn't.
You just need to manage the situation.
Right. Man,
anyway. And that's one of the beautiful things that I see, you know. But yeah. So turn down my 5 sponsors out the gate. There's many people that are going to continue
sponsors.
To stick around because this is a loving program.
Right. But I'm like, you know what? But I didn't. I was just like, oh, I was really bummed out the first one because I really wanted what she had, right? She had this lots of years, but now I'm learning now tying. I really don't mean shit. It's not your time, it's your quality. But I got turned down. Okay, keep going. And I had someone who asked me, they came and approached me and said, can I be your sponsor? I'm new to the program. I'm like, sure, great. I didn't know that that shouldn't be that way, you know, that she shouldn't find me. I should find... Anyway, I fired her after 2 weeks. But that's because she had some health issues. And I'm selfish, right? But I'm in a good way. I need someone who's going to be there for me in my early recovery whenever I call. Like, I mean, if we have a meeting, let's do it. Don't like, oh, well, you got kids, you got this. I need someone who's flexible to work with me. I need it.
Listen, man. That's one of the things I disagree with, what's been laid out since the 80s that I've been told about what a sponsor should be.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's bullshit. And, and you know, the way some hard asses is about it, man. You
right.
know, and I've been fortunate to have a cat in my life for, you know, many, many, many moons. But, you know, there's no way it's supposed to
right.
be.
Right. It just is
what it is. Period, man.
Yeah.
And some of the people that I know that have the best sobriety are the ones that feel the same. That I'm not saying nothing new.
Right.
There's
right.
an impermanence, and I'm catching right. that in my daily nugget. Everything's temporary in right. life, you know, and nothing's new in life, you
yeah.
know. And that's what I. So as far as sponsorship goes, good for you on that,
thanks.
You know.
Yeah. So I finally got a sponsor. Things are going great, right? And you hear all this stuff about this fourth step, and I was drag ass, and I was like, okay, you know what? I have to do this right. I wasn't really dry. I just wanted to do it right. You know, this was, you know, I went this way and I went columns this way and I did this. I balled up this, threw this out. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. There's no right or wrong way. It's my way. It's my life. Let me just get it out on paper. My sponsor, who has more experience, can correct me and teach me and guide me. So I got it out. And I thought it was very cliche, kind of like you hear the, oh, it's so freeing. It's so this. It's, and I'm like, it's such a crock of bullshit. Look at these AA people. Like, you know, how freeing can this really be? Something so fucking simple. Write some shit down. It's trauma, resentments, and, you know, all that stuff. My part, y'all just look at it and then go over it with my sponsor and God. And when I tell you, I've been harboring around this one particular incident. I don't want to get into detail about it because it's kind of graphic, but number one on my resentment list really, really hurt me bad. And I played no freaking part other than I was a child and I didn't tell. But I hated this person. I wanted this person dead. I couldn't stand the thought of this person. And this person's in my family, so I have to see this person. I can't just, it's not just a friend. Well, when I tell you, I thought if I forgive Maddie, that's so that Maddie will be happy. Fuck that. Forgiveness is for me. I have forgiven the people that have hurt me. I've forgiven myself because I was also on my resentment list. I walk around. It's like, man, freeing is beyond freeing. It's like, it's just, man, I feel like I can breathe.
And I didn't
know. I can breathe,
just
man.
Just like you're saying. And I didn't realize. So when Maddie was 8 years old
mm-hmm.
and quite disruptive child,
mm-hmm.
mom and dad sent me on a Saturday to go stay with the head priest of the church
mm-hmm.
that's a friend of the family. And that priest had his way with
right.
me. And since 8 years old until I was fucking at my drunk as hell at my niece's wedding, like 40 years later, 35 right. years later, it comes out how, and my dad had already passed, how much I hated my mom and dad for sending me there.
Right.
And also, and I'm not going to sit here and say that's the reason I got fucked up.
Right.
But what happened was I would never forgive that priest.
Right.
He can die, burn in
right,
hell.
Right, right.
Why would I forgive him?
Right, right.
What did I have to do? I was
right.
8 years
right.
old.
I was a child.
You know, what did I do wrong? And what I found was from great guidance was the forgiveness came from me not holding on to that darkness
mm-hmm.
anymore. Because, and that forgiveness. So I can't sit here today and say I forgive that man
right.
for being a devil's workshop.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. But however I've managed in my mind, I said, it's okay, man.
Right.
And that way I was able to not harbor that. And as far as mom and dad go, with parents, we don't know any better. There's
right.
not a blueprint on raising
right.
children. You do the best you can. And I'm
right.
certainly positive they knew that he was a fucking pedophile.
they wouldn't
have said
anything. Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
But it took, as I destroyed my niece's, well, I didn't destroy the whole wedding, but in my drunken stupor, that comes hollering out. But anyway, so the forgiveness comes for us, you know,
right, right,
and
I never knew that, you know. And so I can honestly say that, you know, now I've forgiven this particular person, well, all the people, but I've forgiven this person because I look back and I'm like, you know, as I've been sick for so many years in the head, not like some illness, but this person was sick. This person probably had the same thing happen to them, and I've forgiven that person, And now I have a relationship with this person. I mean, it's amazing what such simple kindergarten work. Write it down, go over it, read it out loud, talk to a higher power. I choose to call my higher power God, and he will handle it. Now all those things that used to badly happen, flat tire, I ran into a ditch, and, you know, wrecked my car. I was doing bad, so bad kept happening. Now I'm doing the next right thing, and I'm living I'm not lying. I'm not stealing. I'm not cheating. And so many wonderful things are happening. I'm chasing, like, this recovery thing. I'm in the middle of this damn boat. You can't really fall off from the middle. You fall off from the edge. And I've been on the edge for too many years. I am chasing this thing because my life depends on it. Not like my life depends on it, but it does depend on it. If I, you know, so I try to stay spiritually fit, you know, in the moment. So back to the sober house. So I'm talking to my higher power and I'm praying and I'm doing all the things, you know, and like every, you know, my life just started getting good. Like little moments. Like I remember my car, I destroyed my car myself, you know, my inactive addiction. Well, 2 months into recovery, I'm driving down the road. It was actually, we just got finished the International Festival. Last year, the Friday before the International Festival, I was driving down there to set up. The interstate was backed up, so I got off the interstate, took this Broad River all the way down. Get off on Broad River. I'm sitting at the traffic light with my foot on the brake. Bam! This guy runs into the back of me. I look in my rearview mirror. I see old Nancy. A guy jumps out the minivan from this end, one on this end. And I'm like, I got out the car. And so the car made me hit the car in front of me. And I got out the car and I go back there. And I was the first, you know, calling 911. You know, I've been into an accident. Come on, come here. Guy goes, did you call the cops? I'm like, I sure did. Are you okay? Are you okay? So I looked at it like, I don't know, other people look at it differently. That was a God moment. I drove that car in active addiction for so many years. I got into a car accident. They totaled my car. I got a new car, you know, just little things. Yeah. I don't have to live in that, in the remembering of that car and like just little things. My iPhone, brand new iPhone broke right before I went into the sober house, shattered the whole screen. You know, I don't have a job. How am I going to fix it? Da, da, da. So when I left the sober house, I have my broken up phone. I took the SIM card and put it in an old iPhone 6 and anyway, so one day the one guy in the rooms was like, hey, I got a brand new iPhone 11. It's brand new in the box. I got a 14 or something, blah, blah. Here, you can have it. Little things like those things never happened to me when I was on drugs. No way. You know, I would steal things from people, but they were not. And that's to me, I look at it like all God. So I started going to meetings. I'd go to, you know, they say 90 and 90. I blew that shit out of the water because that's what I do, right? Go hard or go home. Got this great sponsor. Okay, now I'm trying to go look for a job because I was tired of mommy leaving me $20 on the stairs so that I could have a dollar in the basket and gas money. So I was like, I'm just going to get a little job. Well, if I'd taken my will, I learned this thing about not my will, right? Because I always took my will. I knew everything that was best for me. And I started practicing, you know, thy will be done, not mine. And another guy in the rooms was like, hey, you want to come work for my dad? If you had told me over a year ago that I'd be working with old people, I would have said, hell no. Like, no way. I get disgusted wiping my nephew's ass. Like, just no way. So, but now I get to do God's service work, man. I get to give back because I took for so many years. And I get to give back. I am the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. I have a job at an assisted living home. I've had the first job that I've ever had for a whole year. Never called out of work. Got PTO. Went on a work conference, business trip. Like things I've never done. And I'm almost 50 years old. I've never done these things. But so it's just been an amazing journey so
far. What's been the toughest part of sobriety?
So, I don't know. So, I know... In a way, like, you know, I hear people sharing in the rooms and they're talking about the worst year of their life is first year of sobriety, this, that, the other. I want to honestly say for a while, I thought there was something wrong with me because I'm like, well, why is my journey, my first year has been pretty freaking amazing. Like my life is great. And then I start looking at it like, and I know I'm not special. So I haven't lost my family members yet. I haven't lost a job. I haven't totaled my car. I haven't broken a leg. Yeah, I don't have cancer, God forbid. I don't have any of those bad things that are happening. And I know that they will happen, but
perception.
Yeah. But
you've got perception.
My life is pretty fucking great. I can't say that I've had a struggle every day. I have these tools. I practice. I give it to God. I pray. I try to be the best. I'm better today than I was yesterday. Tomorrow, I want to be better than the next day. Like, I keep doing the next right thing. You know, sometimes we don't know what the next right thing is, but I damn sure know what the wrong thing is. So don't do that. You know,
sometimes it's so simple, this
right.
program, right?
It's so simple for complicated people. We complicate it. Like, you know, you don't want to steal anymore, then don't. You don't want to lie, don't. I don't want to get high anymore, then don't pick it up. You won't get high. You know, so I honestly can't say that there's been anything tough. Awesome. It has been great, an amazing
man.
Journey.
That's okay, man. And there doesn't have to be a tough part of sobriety, you know, and it's beautiful to hear that.
It's amazing. It's been amazing.
And what's been revealed to you as the most beautiful gift sobriety has given you?
That's
be a tough call to sum it up as one, but what's right. a big one that pops out?
Just
what's a beautiful
that I'm
gift?
Present. I'm present for my family. Nice. When I'm there for my nephews, I'm there to play. Yesterday, I jumped on the trampoline with my nieces. I'm just there for my family. I'm present. I'm not just there, like, because I've been there, but been out of my mind, but I'm there. Like Christmas, I spent the best Christmas. I got to, and it's not about gifts, but I got to buy gifts. I got to play with the gifts with my nieces and nephew. I got to sit with my mom and my dad, who God knows how long I'm going to have them. But I got to bring them peace of mind for the first time in all my life. They've always worried about me. I've always brought chaos to their life and hurt and sorrow. And how many times I've seen my mom cry, my dad, a grown man cry, my brother's grown men. Now I'm present and I get to be there for them and they don't have to worry. My family doesn't worry anymore. Now they worry, God forbid, if I got to an accident or something, but they don't worry about me. Yeah. They don't.
Mom said sobriety. She told me she said serenity prayer for 32 years every day.
My mom lit a candle every day. Every day that I was at home, my mom would light a candle and put it by this cross and, you know, and it was horrible what I put myself through, but everybody who loves me, like I come from a rock star family who truly loves me. No matter what I've done to them, they've always been there. And now I'm there. I get to be there for them.
It's mom told me to, I think you heard that before when she said it, which was, you know, it's humbling to me is that mom says she doesn't even know who I am.
Right.
And she's seen me before in other times of my life in sobriety, but you know, I was always I consumed so much from so many people and just from life and was just so dark and just a scary, toxic person. But so mom says, so when I hear mom say that, that right there would be one of the most beautiful gifts.
Even like walking around the, like talking with my mom and dad and my brothers and we're all at the house. And like I made something the other day and my mom was like, oh, that's really good. The way I would have used to respond was like, I know, duh. Like I made it, duh. You know, it was all about me. I was God's gift on earth. You were better because I was around, right? But now it's like, or even just chiming in with a conversation with my mom, if she has something to say about so-and-so did this. I live by this principle. If it does not fucking concern me, then stay out of it. I can be there to listen, but that's it. I don't chime in on, I'm not the one who takes gossip. Like I used to be the person, you tell me something, I'm going to tell this person. Why am I character assassinating anyone? You know, I'm no longer that person.
All of that stuff. Didn't even realize how much darkness, all of that, my opinion, is that gossip, everything kind of so much darkness.
Right.
And it just multiplies and compounds. It becomes so thick. And that's what I talk about, man. And now it's just such a life of, you know, when I said, from darkness to
redemption,
to redemption. And I had this cat I met down out of Charleston, who's a hopeful with some sober homes. He goes, Maddie, I think, a lot of it. He said, I think it should be from darkness to freedom. And I thought about that. And at first I was like, I said, Rory. And in my mind, I was like, you know what? It's not just redemption, you know, it's redemption because I'm getting back.
Right.
You know, getting back to fucking what I thought about. I said, this is freedom because I was in such a jail.
Yeah, I have such peace now. I've never known peace ever. I could be in the middle of a church and I didn't have peace. I have peace like no other. I can lay my head down and go to sleep and I don't have to think about, like, you know, I used to keep myself awake with all the things like, oh my God, well, is Maddie going to find out that I did this? Is so-and-so going to find out I did this? That, you know, like, I don't have that. That doesn't weigh on me anymore. I put my head down and I go to sleep so peacefully. I wake up with peace. When my phone rings, I don't have to worry about, oh my God, who is it? What's going on? You know, I don't have to worry about who did I sleep with? What did I do? I just have such peace and such serenity. And my life is so peaceful and it's amazing. It's truly amazing because that's like a gift. I've never had that ever. I'm experiencing a lot of firsts and they're all wonderful. And I know the dark, you know, I'm going to get hit because I'm not special, but I try to keep spiritually fit. I try to stay around my people, like-minded people that have been through what I've been through that I can come to and say, hey, Maddie, I'm feeling this way. You know, you can tell me, oh, well, I have too. And, you know, what you do, give me, you know, tips. We can be there for one another. I can get myself fucked up. We can do this together.
That's right.
And stay healthy and sober.
And that's an absolutely beautiful way to end this. This is a great podcast, man.
I thank you so much.
Super cool that we got together. Super cool that we're both still alive.
Yeah, God.
And that's a God thing right there.
Amen.
Because we're both gonna go on the same thing. Recover loudly, man.
Real
so
loud.
You suffer in silence, man. So beautiful again, Nancy. I love you.
I love you too.
We got lots of time together, man.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you again, Nancy, for taking the time to come out, sit down with me. Do some reminiscing, lots of laughs, the darkness that we went through. It's, you know, the freedom we have now. It's absolutely a miracle. Such a joy that the journey that we will share together as we travel through sobriety. Listen, guys, the Lose Control Podcast, a paradox for positive, peaceful living. You can find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Podchaser. Please follow us, share. It's a beautiful thing. Thanks for joining us. The Lose Control Podcast is committed to you becoming part of a healthy tribe, and we will transform our lives together.